Welcome to The Deep Dive. I'm Jamie Murdoch.
And I'm Taylor Newhouse.
This week, we're diving deep into the latest issue of The Economist for the week of September 6th to 12th, 25. Our mission, as always, is really to cut through the noise, distill the most crucial information, and bring you those surprising facts and, you know, deeper implications that truly shape our world.
We've scoured every page from, well, the volatile landscapes of global geopolitics and the shifting sands of economic power,
right,
to the cutting edge of technology, public health breakthroughs, and even the evolving fabric of our culture.
It's packed.
This edition is definitely packed.
Yeah.
And we're here to give you that vital shortcut to being genuinely well-informed, connecting the dots, and revealing what really matters in this, well, increasingly complex world.
Okay, let's jump right in.
Let's do it.
We're kicking things off in the ever-turbulent realm of geopolitics. And there are some, frankly, deeply concerning developments in the Middle East. Our first look is at Israel's settlers make their move. And it really lays bare a significant and unsettling shift.
Yeah.
The article highlights the reopening of a nursery in Homesh, a Jewish settlement in the occupied West Bank.
Right.
What makes this particularly notable is that Homesh was actually dismantled 20 years ago under Ariel Sharon's disengagement plan.
Exactly. That's key context.
So the fact that it's now being rebuilt and with clear government backing, that's a powerful statement.
It is. And what's truly striking here is the open rhetoric. Israel's finance minister, Bezalel Smotrich, celebrated this reopening as a, quote, vindication. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Directly linking it to a vision for permanent Israeli control and, controversially, the displacement of over 2 million Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank.
Wow.
This isn't some, you know, quiet backroom discussion. It's an openly stated goal among religious nationalist groups, especially amplified since the war began almost 2 years ago.
Right.
It marks a profound shift in the regional discourse. What was once considered, frankly, unthinkable is now a publicly discussed policy aim.
And the article points out that Prime Minister Netanyahu isn't offering any specific withdrawal timeline for Gaza.
No timeline.
Which, of course, only emboldens this settler vision. The IDF operations in Gaza City are, well, literally paving new routes through the coastal strip.
Yeah, and while they say it's for military purposes, these routes kind of conveniently correspond to maps drawn up by settler organizations.
For potential new communities.
Exactly, for potential new communities. These groups are already actively recruiting for these planned outposts. It suggests a future landscape dramatically different from what many have envisioned.
And it's not just Gaza. Beyond Gaza, the situation in the West Bank shows a rapidly tightening grip.
Definitely.
There are already 500,000 Israeli settlers living among 3.3 million Palestinians.
It's a huge number. And over 100 kilometers of new Israeli-only roads have been cut through Palestinian areas.
Explicitly designed to cement Israeli dominance, create facts on the ground.
Right. And perhaps most critically, the government recently authorized nearly 4,000 new settler homes, many in the highly controversial E1 project.
E1, yeah. That's the one designed to physically cut the West Bank in half, right?
Precisely. Preventing any geographical contiguity for a future Palestinian state. It makes that idea physically almost impossible.
And it's not just official policy. It's backed by actions on the ground, too.
Mm-hmm.
Settlers using violent intimidation, often, the article says, with the tacit support of the IDF, to force Palestinians from their homes and farms.
Yeah, and Israel's military operations in places like Jenin and Tulkarm now resemble their Gaza tactics, flattening neighborhoods, displacing tens of thousands of Palestinians.
So what are the wider implications here?
They're significant. Countries like France, Britain, Canada, and Australia are planning to recognize Palestinian statehood in response to this escalating situation in Gaza. In turn, some Israeli ministers are openly urging formal annexation of the West Bank in response to this international move.
Wow, so a real escalation.
A huge escalation. It would directly challenge the Abraham Accords and U.S. diplomatic pressure. The accelerating pace of settlement activity and military operations points to, well, a fundamental shift in the regional power balance.
Potentially foreclosing the possibility of a two-state solution.
Absolutely. Mm. And inevitably leading to increased international isolation for Israel. This isn't just a series of events. It's a rapidly hardening geopolitical reality.
Mm. Okay, and from one Middle Eastern powder keg to another, we turn to Iran's imminent nuclear dilemma.
Right.
The 2015 nuclear deal, the JCPOA, is now being described as an empty shell.
Pretty much, yeah. Britain, France, and Germany have officially notified the UN Security Council about Iran's violations.
Triggering that 30-day countdown to compliance, the snapback mechanism.
Exactly, snapback.
Yeah.
And the breaches detailed in the article are pretty significant. Iran has accumulated over 8,000 kilograms of uranium.
Far exceeding the 300-kilogram limit set by the JCPOA.
Way over. But more alarming is that over 400 kilograms of that has been refined to 60% purity, which is, you know, a dangerously short step from weapons-grade material.
Chutzky percent. Yeah.
And the snapback provision, which would automatically restore UN sanctions, expires on October 18th, and with Russia set to assume the Security Council presidency next month.
The diplomatic path forward becomes even more complicated.
Extremely complicated.
Oh, so Iran finds itself with a few stark options, and none of them look easy.
Not at all. They could choose defiance, right? Some lawmakers are pushing for a withdrawal from the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, halting talks, suspending cooperation with the IAEA, the UN nuclear watchdog.
But that path carries immense risks. Mm-hmm. Harsh international reactions, potentially even airstrikes from Israel or America.
Which already bombed some Iranian facilities back in June, remember?
Right. Okay, so defiance is risky. What about compliance?
Compliance is another option, but that's unlikely to satisfy a Donald Trump administration, which would likely demand full dismantlement of enrichment capabilities.
And Iran insists on enrichment as a sovereign right.
They do, steadfastly. So a third, perhaps more likely option is to try and buy time. Russia has proposed a 6-month extension. Iran might try to weather reimposed sanctions, perhaps expecting some trading partners to just ignore them.
Yeah, maybe banking on a chaotic Trump administration struggling with enforcement.
That seems to be part of the calculation, yeah. They might even offer talks on a new deal and IAEA inspections, but there's always the inherent risk they'd use that time to quietly restart or accelerate their nuclear program.
Especially given the uncertainty about the damage from those June strikes.
Precisely.
So the impact here is monumental. The larger question we're left with is, will diplomacy ultimately prevail, or is the region really on the precipice of a new nuclear crisis?
The stakes are incredibly high. Potential for renewed conflict, a breakdown of global arms control agreements. It's serious.
Absolutely. Okay, shifting our gaze slightly north now, let's turn to Europe and a fascinating historical parallel drawn in what Finland could teach Ukraine about war and peace.
Oh, this was a really interesting piece.
It directly compares Finland's experience in the 1940s when Stalin invaded after a rejected land swap to Ukraine's current situation.
Right. Finland, despite receiving Western promises of support that ultimately fell short.
Which sounds familiar.
It does, doesn't it? Finland lost 10% of its territory, including Karelia, and adopted neutrality. But critically, it retained its independence and democracy.
It's a striking parallel because in both cases, Russia claimed a sphere of influence, invaded expecting a quick victory, while Western democracies struggled with the scale and speed of their support.
But Finland's resilience is a key takeaway here. President Alexander Stubb, whose father was actually born in the annexed territory, he emphasizes that Finland won by retaining its independence.
How did they manage that?
Well, commanded by Carl Gustav Mannerheim, they accepted a bitter peace but fundamentally stuck to their core values: universal education, social welfare, the rule of law.
And they developed that total defense system.
Exactly. Compulsory national service, 1 million trained citizens, eventually joining NATO in 2023.
So what's Stubbs' message to Ukraine?
It's particularly insightful. He argues that Ukraine is actually in a far better position than Finland was in 1944.
Really? How so?
Finland was devastated, poor, very little external support. Ukraine, by contrast, has robust allies, security guarantees, significant economic help.
So the choice, he suggests, is
to rebuild, believe in its future, eradicate corruption, foster freedom and justice, and importantly, kill cynicism.
What truly struck me about this article is that it's more than just a history lesson. It feels like a strategic playbook.
It does.
The Finlandization approach, often viewed by some as appeasement, was real politic for Finland, allowing it to thrive despite its powerful neighbor.
Right, a pragmatic survival strategy. Yeah.
So the crucial question for us now is, how applicable is that hard-won lesson for Ukraine today, given its broader international support and, frankly, significantly different geopolitical context?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it? A powerful thought experiment for modern statecraft.
Indeed. And the pressure on Russia isn't just external. It's also facing significant internal challenges. Two articles highlight this. First, Vladimir Putin is building a super app, which notes that Russia's internet watchdog is restricting calls on popular messaging services like WhatsApp and Telegram.
Yeah, tightening control. And Putin has signed a decree to create a state-endorsed app called Amex by VK.
And this app is clearly inspired by China's WeChat, right? Aiming to combine messaging, e-government services, payments, mini-apps.
All in one place. And it will be pre-installed on all new devices. It's a clear move towards greater state control and surveillance.
But is the public buying it?
Well, public skepticism is high. Over a third of Russians already use VPNs to bypass restrictions. And there are genuine fears that this new app could allow authorities to hack phone microphones or even cameras. Trust is low.
Okay, so internal control issues. And adding to Russia's woes is Putin's petrostate faces a kamikaze petrol crisis.
Yeah, this is significant. Ukraine's kamikaze drone campaign has notably shifted into higher gear. Over a dozen strikes on Russian oil refineries and distribution systems, like those in Krasnodar and Syzran.
Directly impacting fuel supplies to Russian military units.
Directly. The impact is substantial. The article estimates that up to 20% of Russia's refining capacity, that's over 1 million barrels per day of petrol and diesel, has been taken out, at least temporarily.
20%. Wow.
And the destruction of cracking units, which are vital for producing later fuels, is particularly damaging because they're so difficult to replace due to sanctions.
So what's the result on the ground?
Petrol shortages, long queues, wholesale prices up a record 54% since the start of the year. Russia has even suspended gasoline exports. And in some regions, petrol rationing has been ordered.
All of this significantly contributes to Russia's fiscal woes.
Hugely. A reported $61.4 billion deficit in the first 7 months of the year, almost 3% of its full-year GDP.
And these Ukrainian drones, they're getting quite sophisticated.
They are. The FP1 long-range drone, for example, is being produced at about 100 units a day, costing around $55,000 each.
And they carry a substantial warhead, long-range.
Yep, 60-120-kilogram warhead, up to 1,600-kilometer range, and sophisticated software for accurate targeting even under electronic warfare conditions. They also have heavier, costlier, looty drones.
So these two stories, the super app and the petrol crisis, though seemingly disparate,
they paint a clear picture of the internal and external pressures on Russia. The super app is about greater state control and surveillance, but its success is uncertain.
Right, given public resistance.
Exactly. And the petrol crisis, a direct result of Ukrainian military action, could significantly weaken Russia's economy and military capabilities, adding to the pressure on Putin.
What this all means for the duration and intensity of the conflict is, well, a prolonged and increasingly challenging period for the Kremlin.
A slow but steady squeeze, seems like.
Okay, now, let's pivot to the American political landscape, which continues to be profoundly shaped by Donald Trump.
Always a complex picture there.
Our first article here is America's Missing Opposition, and it paints a stark, almost perplexing picture, despite President Donald Trump's net approval rating being minus 14 percentage points.
Which is quite low.
Right. The article states he seems to be getting his way.
It really is a confounding puzzle. The article offers a few key reasons for this phenomenon. Firstly, his speed.
Speed?
Yeah. Trump moves much faster than the cumbersome forces that typically constrain a president, acting like the TikTok algorithm, as they put it.
Grabbing attention, defining the narrative before opponents can react.
Exactly. For example, the Supreme Court hasn't even ruled on his June deployment of troops to Los Angeles. Tariffs can take months to address. While courts deliberate, he just moves on to the next thing.
Resetting the clock, keeping the opposition perpetually on the back foot.
Precisely. Another major factor the article highlights is the remarkably servile Republican Party.
His approval among Republicans is almost 90%.
Almost 90. And the party's organizing principle has effectively become that Mr. Trump is always right. Policy debates, the article laments, have largely devolved into theological disputes over the true meaning of his words rather than substantive arguments.
And then there's the coordination problem among independent institutions, companies, universities, news organizations.
Right. They struggle to coordinate a unified opposition because they are, by nature, competitors. Makes it easier for Trump to pick them off individually.
Meanwhile, the Democrats are depicted as being in considerable disarray.
Yeah, that's putting it mildly. Voter registrations are down by 4.5 million in just 4 years across 30 states.
Wow.
And the party itself has a 28-point net unfavorability rating, which is actually worse than the Republicans.
Worse than the Republicans.
Okay. They often sound perpetually pessimistic, focused, the article suggests, on managing decline and redistributing scarcity rather than championing a vision of growth and opportunity.
Trump's skill in setting traps for Democrats is also explicitly highlighted.
Oh, yeah. Consider the looming federal debt ceiling vote. Democrats will face a stark choice between significant foreign aid cuts or a government shutdown.
A classic Trump move.
Or his move to send National Guard troops into cities like Los Angeles and Chicago to quell protests against illegal immigrants. Democrats decry this as executive overreach.
But Trump expertly frames them as siding with criminals.
Exactly. Similarly, the drone strikes on alleged drug smugglers, which we'll discuss in a moment, present a dilemma. It's hard to oppose the lack of due process without sounding like a defender of violent gangs.
So the impact here is profound for American democracy. The core question becomes, can the Democrats effectively check presidential power, especially with the midterms a year away, even with Trump's clear unpopularity among the broader electorate?
The article really highlights deep structural issues within American democracy and its political parties. It suggests a significant challenge to the traditional system of checks and balances. It's less about a single policy and more about a fundamental rebalancing of power.
And speaking of stretching executive power, Trump's tariffs suffer a legal setback. Details a federal appeals court ruling that President Trump cannot single-handedly rejig America's tariff schedules.
Right, but a key point. Those tariffs remain in effect during his Supreme Court appeal, so this is, at best, a temporary reprieve.
Okay, so the fight isn't over. What's the legal challenge here?
It centers on Trump's use of the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, or IEEPA. He cited that for tariffs related to the fentanyl crisis and trade deficits.
And the court said.
The appeals court ruled that IEEPA does not explicitly mention duties or tariffs, concluding he exceeded his authority.
Okay, so this now sets up a potential Supreme Court showdown.
Exactly, where the justices might employ either the major questions doctrine or the non-delegation doctrine to define the limits of presidential power in this area.
If the Supreme Court sides with Trump on this, it would be a significant expansion of executive power, wouldn't it?
Huge. And they would have to reconcile it with their prior rejection of Biden's student loan forgiveness plan, which they struck down due to a perceived lack of clear congressional authorization.
Right. And even if Trump ultimately loses this specific legal battle, the article points out he has other tools.
He does. Other tools at his disposal, like the Trade Expansion Act of 1962 and the Trade Act of 1974, he has options.
So this illustrates the ongoing legal challenges to Trump's executive power and the potential for the Supreme Court to reshape the balance of power between the presidency and Congress.
With significant global commerce implications, it highlights the dynamic tension between the executive branch's desire for swift, decisive action and the constitutional limits on its authority.
Okay. Now, a different kind of executive pressure is detailed in. Donald Trump comes for America's public universities.
Yeah, this is a worrying one.
The Department of Justice alleged that UCLA was deliberately indifferent to anti-Semitic harassment. And in a striking move, the Trump administration froze $584 million in research grants from the NSF and NIH.
$584 million. And they're demanding $1 billion, a ban on overnight protests, and other policy changes to release these funds.
A former provost, Donald Heller, explicitly called this extortion.
Extortion, yeah. And what makes this a new and significant stage in Trump's strategy is that previous attacks largely targeted wealthy private schools.
Right, the Ivies.
Exactly, attacking public universities, which educate 75% of American students and are crucial for upward mobility and much of the nation's research, has a much broader, more devastating impact. For context, UCLA ranks 7th in NSF grants, while Harvard is 15th.
So what's the response been?
The University of California's Board of Regents has been notably tight-lipped, but Governor Gavin Newsom has publicly vowed to sue.
Okay.
Meanwhile, UCLA itself has already demonstrated what the article calls anticipatory obedience.
Anticipatory obedience.
Yeah. Banning encampments, eliminating diversity statements, settling a lawsuit with Jewish students, seemingly trying to preempt further federal action.
So what are the profound implications here?
It isn't just about university policy. It's about the weaponization of federal funding and the chilling effect it has on academic freedom and dissent, particularly in Democrat-run states.
raises serious questions about political influence over scientific research and education.
Absolutely. And the pressure on institutions to conform to a specific political agenda, regardless of academic autonomy, it's a very pointed use of federal leverage.
And yet another instance of stretching executive authority is explored in The Dubious Legality of Killing Drug Suspects at Sea.
Right. President Donald Trump celebrated a military strike on September 2nd on a Venezuelan boat in the Southern Caribbean. He claimed it carried drugs and narco-terrorists from the Trendyarago gang, resulting in 11 deaths.
And he publicly stated, there's more where that came from.
He did. Now, this was undoubtedly smart politics for Trump. Drug gangs are highly unpopular. 80,000 Americans tragically died of overdoses last year.
Framing the action as protecting American lives resonates.
It absolutely resonates with a broad electorate. However, the legal justification is a significant stretch. Previous presidents, like Obama, had congressional authorization for targeted killings of alleged terrorists post 9/11. Trump is attempting to extend that authority dramatically.
That designating drug cartels as terrorists.
Exactly. Which is a dubious classification, given that cartels primarily have commercial, not political, goals. Furthermore, his previous claim of a Venezuelan government-backed invasion was rejected by an appeals court.
So the consequences of such actions are dire. Extrajudicial execution for the 11 killed.
And alleged invaders in America sent to Salvadoran prisons without trial, effectively bypassing due process.
What's the conventional approach here?
Conventional approach to drug interdiction involves stopping, searching, arresting if drugs are found. Trump hopes a show of force will deter smugglers. But history shows that squeezing supply often just raises prices and calls forth new supply.
Including synthetic drugs like fentanyl that can be made domestically.
Exactly. So this compels us to ask, how far can a president stretch legal justifications for military action? What are the long-term consequences for international law, human rights, and the overall fight against drug trafficking?
It opens up a troubling cognitive space for the further militarization of the drug war.
That's the phrase the article uses, yeah. Very concerning.
Okay, shifting to the internal dynamics of the Republican Party. Five Republican factions jostle for the president's favor. Notes that while the party appears united by a near universal devotion to Donald Trump.
This actually masks deep divisions among its voters.
Right. What are these factions?
The article identifies several distinct groups. Anti-establishment populists, old school conservatives, nationalists, isolationists. It's a mixed bag.
Well, what's particularly interesting, though, is that despite these internal ideological differences, core policies like building a wall along the Mexican border and skepticism of gender ideology command majorities across all these tribes.
Which suggests a powerful unifying narrative beyond traditional party lines.
So Trump's skill then lies in his unique ability to bind these competing factions together.
Appealing to all while seemingly alienating none. He has managed to create a political force that transcends traditional ideological divides within his party, making it exceptionally resilient to internal challenges.
This is fascinating because it illustrates how Trump's personal appeal has forged this unique and powerful political force.
Absolutely. And his successor will undoubtedly struggle to replicate this ability to unite such disparate groups. Significant implications for the future direction and cohesion of the Republican Party once Trump inevitably exits the stage.
Right. And finally, for this section, Lexington offers a somber, cautionary reflection in The Rules for Defending Democracy Under Donald Trump.
It references a 1945 War Department fact sheet that warned troops against fascism at home,
emphasizing that economic stress and division could create vulnerabilities, encouraging critical thought and vigilance.
And this historical warning is directly connected to Trump's contemporary actions, like his administration banning certain books from military service academies.
And his stated desire to restore the name Department of War, claiming, as Department of War, we want everything.
Yeah. The article's author, Mr. Carey, compares Trump to the Wizard of Oz, suggesting frightened people grant him power, and explicitly refers to his aims as fascism, pointing to the unsettling prospect of armored combat vehicles in the streets as a concern for civil liberties.
This piece powerfully connects historical warnings about fascism to contemporary political actions.
Prompts reflection on the health of American democracy and the vital role of military and public education in protecting its norms. It's a compelling call for continued vigilance and critical thinking in the face of perceived threats to democratic institutions.
Okay, now let's turn our attention to the Democrats and their current challenges and potential opportunities.
Right. What's their path forward?
Our first article here is America Needs Smarter AI Policies. The Democrats Can Provide Them, featuring insights from Gina Raimondo, a former Commerce Secretary. She argues that Donald Trump won in 2024 largely due to his laser focus on economic anxiety.
A key factor, certainly.
And that the Democrats now have a significant opening to address voters' economic insecurity, especially fears surrounding artificial intelligence.
This is a critical strategic point. Raimondo reframes AI not just as a niche tech issue, but as a core economic one. She warns that AI is poised to disrupt workplaces on a massive scale, potentially causing a tsunami of unemployment that could be far faster and more severe than past disruptions like the China shock. Democrats, she believes, should strategically position themselves as the party that not only understands this impending revolution, but also has concrete plans to help voters stay economically secure through it.
So what kind of policies does she propose?
Two key areas. First, a dedicated focus on mid-career education and retraining, because the American system, she notes, is generally terrible at supporting people through such significant transitions.
An area where Democrats could genuinely make a difference for a vast swath of middle-aged working-class voters.
Exactly. Second, she argues the government needs to work proactively with the AI industry to pass legislation with teeth, steering the technology to benefit ordinary people and balancing its progress with essential guardrails to protect workers and society.
This highlights a critical, forward-looking policy challenge that could genuinely define future elections.
Absolutely. The idea of reframing AI as a core economic issue, rather than just a technical one, opens up entirely new avenues for political engagement. It could allow the Democrats to connect with a broad swath of voters who are feeling increasingly economically vulnerable in a rapidly changing world. It's about finding a new economic message that resonates.
Okay. Building on that, how America's Democrats might win back power offers a blunt, almost brutal assessment.
Yeah, this one didn't pull punches.
Democrats are lost, desperately need to get their act together, seen as dinosaurs even by their own voters. They've lost 4.5 million voter registrations in just 4 years across 30 states.
A staggering decline. Internal divisions are rampant within the party. They're locked in debates over whether to lurch further left or cleave to the center.
Denounce Trump versus promote their own platform.
Fight hard and dirty versus go high. It's all over the place. The significant problem, the article highlights, is what it terms the wokeness problem.
The wokeness problem.
Yeah. Like Bill Clinton's sister soldier moment in 1992, Democrats struggle with wildly out-of-touch social positions and, to quote the article, obfuscatory enforcers of wokeness.
Examples cited include a medical student who became a Republican over campus rhetoric and Kamala Harris's comment on gender-affirming surgery for prisoners.
Things that actively alienate crucial swing voters. And swing voters, representing a significant 20% of the electorate, actually supported Trump over Harris in 2024.
But now they disapprove of Trump's handling of crime, immigration, the economy, and especially inflation.
Especially inflation, where his net approval is a stark minus 40. Trump's erratic tariffs are expected to function as a tax on everyday families.
And his plans to slash health care, Medicaid cuts, ending Obamacare subsidies.
That will cause costs to soar for an estimated 20 million Americans. This creates a clear and present opening for Democrats on tangible economic issues.
So what are the proposed Democratic solutions?
The article suggests several. On the left, there's a call for old-fashioned public spending, squeezing the rich. Moderates, however, advocate for abundance through loosening regulations for housing and energy projects.
Citing successful examples like Cincinnati zoning reforms.
Right. They also need to address how the weaponization of regulation by special interests has alienated voters, especially young teachers, nurses, small business owners struggling with high housing costs and crazy permit systems for things like food trucks.
Okay. What about immigration?
On immigration, Trump's approval among swing voters actually plunged from plus 18 to minus 18.
A big drop.
Huge. Giving Democrats an opening with a plan for enhanced border controls while simultaneously restoring due process. They also need to deftly navigate Trump's attempts to goad them into appearing to side with criminals on law and order issues.
And critically, while fear and loathing of Trump animate much of the Democratic base.
Allusions to the Third Reich persuade few swing voters. Pete Buttigieg, for example, argues they need to relate autocracy to how everyday life is different.
citing tangible concerns like incompetent health officials and a rise in measles.
Exactly. Tangible impacts. New tactics are emerging, like Governor Newsom actively trolling Trump on X, scrapping nonpartisan electoral boundaries in some areas to gerrymander for advantage.
And betting markets, perhaps surprisingly, now give Democrats a 68% chance of winning the House in 2026.
Interesting odds. So what does this all mean for the party? The Democrats face a monumental challenge to redefine their identity, genuinely connect with everyday economic struggles, and present a cohesive, compelling alternative to Trumpism rather than merely reacting to it.
It's a make-or-break moment for the party's long-term relevance and future.
Absolutely.
Okay, transitioning from the grand stage of politics to how we live, learn, and even perceive our health, let's explore some fascinating insights into social policy and behavior.
All right, more grounded stuff.
First up, banning smartphones in classrooms helps students. This article highlights a new, large-scale, randomized controlled trial, an RCT, conducted in India.
The gold standard of evidence.
Exactly. And it provides what's described as strong causal evidence that banning phones actually improves classroom results.
And this is a rare example of a truly bipartisan policy, right? Gaining traction across America, 35 states with laws or rules. And globally, too.
40% of national education systems adopting similar measures. Tell us about this study.
The study, led by Alp Sungu, involved over 16,955 pupils across 2,000 courses and 10 higher education institutions in India. The results were compelling.
What did they find?
Phone-free students showed an average 0.086 standard deviation increase in GPA. The biggest gains were observed among low performers and in non-STEM subjects.
No. 0.086 standard deviations. That's significant, is that really?
Well, while it sounds small, it's comparable to, as the article puts it, swapping a mediocre teacher with a very good one for a term.
Okay, that puts it in perspective.
And this seemingly small improvement can significantly reduce dropout rates and increase graduation rates, especially for vulnerable students.
And beyond grades.
Beyond mere grades, the article notes these bans also created a demonstrably better learning environment. Less chatter, less disruptive behavior.
Teachers themselves used their phones less, were more engaged, even reduced cheating.
Exactly. Now, the study has limitations, of course. Confined to India, cultural differences, age group specific, benefits more visible in non-STEM. But
it nevertheless provides that gold standard of evidence for a policy debated for years, often based on anecdote rather than data.
Precisely. This is groundbreaking because it offers robust scientific backing for a seemingly simple intervention that can have significant positive effects on academic outcomes and classroom dynamics.
Particularly for vulnerable students.
Particularly. It suggests that, despite initial resistance, phone bans are a surprisingly effective and worthwhile strategy to improve educational environments globally. It's a powerful argument for prioritizing focus over distraction.
Okay, next. How to Study People Who Are Very Drunk delves into the booming field of naturalistic studies in neuroscience and psychology.
This was fascinating. These studies, freed from the often artificial constraints of traditional clinical trials, offer unprecedented insights into real-world behavior.
And they're quicker and cheaper to conduct. A trend accelerated post-COVID.
Exactly. And what's truly fascinating here is how researchers are pushing ethical boundaries to gain these insights into real-world scenarios.
Like the Minnesota State Fair study.
Exactly. Researchers tested 149 people with blood alcohol levels up to 0.15 GDL, far beyond what would typically be allowed in controlled lab trials.
And they found pain tolerance demonstrably rose with alcohol levels.
Which helps create better models for understanding how people with chronic pain might self-medicate with alcohol, real-world data.
And the applications of this methodological shift are incredibly broad.
Oh, yeah. Studying effects of recreational drugs like ecstasy, LSD, without formal trial permissions. Online programs for problem drinking. One study with 46,000 people showed a 1/3 reduction in weekly consumption after 3 months.
Wow. Hangover research, too.
Even hangover research. A Netherlands study observed people with blood alcohol levels over 0.2 GDL.
And for neurological effects.
Researchers are scanning brains while people watch emotionally engaging films like Back to the Future or Pulp Fiction to trigger more natural, complex emotional responses, moving beyond artificial lab stimuli.
And using YouTube videos for AI training.
Yeah, a new database of real-world pleasure and agony facial expressions sourced from YouTube is being used to train advanced AI models for more accurate pain recognition in hospitals.
The profound impact comes down to this. This methodological shift offers powerful tools to study complex, often unethical to replicate, human behaviors in their natural context.
It promises to paint a far more accurate picture of how our brains and bodies truly respond in the messy reality of daily life, with direct applications from public health interventions to cutting-edge AI development.
Okay. Finally, in this segment, let's address some pervasive health misinformation with the truth about seed oils.
Ah, yes, the seed oil debate.
This article directly counters claims from influential figures like Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and various wellness influencers who assert that common seed oils are toxic and inherently harmful.
Claims that have even led some fast food chains to swap them out for alternatives like beef tallow or avocado oil.
So how does the article debunk these claims?
Systematically, by scrutinizing the underlying science, critics frequently point to the chemical processing involved, like using hexane for oil extraction.
Right.
However, the article explains the oil undergoes rigorous filtering and heating, leaving toxicologically insignificant traces for typical consumption levels. That's according to federal government assessments. The idea these trace amounts pose a significant threat isn't borne out by evidence.
What about the omega-6 fatty acids? Critics claim linoleic acid is pro-inflammatory,
causing cancer, heart attacks, obesity. That's the claim. But the article clarifies linoleic acid actually breaks down into both pro-inflammatory and anti-inflammatory compounds. Its overall effect is complex.
And critically, randomized controlled trials show no overall significant effect on inflammatory markers from typical consumption.
Exactly. In fact, the consensus from scientific research suggests the opposite. Seed oils are generally high in healthy polyunsaturated fats,
which are well established to lower cholesterol and significantly cut the risk of heart attacks.
Right. Long-term observational studies, like one following 100,000 American health professionals and a comprehensive WHO review, consistently link higher omega-6 intake to longer, healthier lives.
So the article's conclusion is pretty unequivocal.
It is. Seed oils are unlikely to cause harm. In fact, they are probably good for you, especially in moderation as part of a balanced diet. Furthermore, they are much healthier than some of the alternatives championed by their critics, like butter, lard, and beef tallow.
So this article really helps cut through a lot of that noise, doesn't it?
It does. It's a powerful reminder of why, especially in our current climate of wellness fads and online misinformation, relying on solid scientific evidence for public health guidance isn't just important.
It's absolutely critical for us all to develop that skill of critical thinking.
Definitely. Challenges us to look beyond the trendy and embrace the evidence.
Okay, let's shift our focus now to the significant economic and political currents reshaping Europe.
Right. Big shifts happening there.
Starting with a powerful and concerning trend, the rise of the hard right. Our first two articles, The Hard Right's Plans for Europe's Economy and Bond Vigilantes Take Aim at France, paint a rather stark picture.
Yeah, Europe's hard right is rapidly gaining power. Leading polls in Britain, France, Germany, already in office in Italy, coalitions in the Netherlands, presidential win in Poland.
The article estimates that by 2027, these parties could be governing economies worth almost half of Europe's GDP.
Almost half. And this development, the article strongly argues, poses a, quote, grave blow to prosperity across the continent.
Why?
These parties, it notes, sneer at technocratic management, actively seek to protect their voters from competition, and often offer a seductive combination of handouts and tax cuts that are fiscally unsustainable,
leading to economic stagnation or, even worse, rolling bond market blowups as investors lose confidence.
Exactly. And what's particularly concerning is how mainstream parties are also reacting, sometimes cowering, even aping extreme policies,
which paradoxically risks accelerating the very hard right victories they hope to avoid.
Right. Europe's economic context is already fragile. Annual GDP growth across the continent is barely 1%.
We're already seeing record high bond yields in the UK and France.
And Germany, the continent's economic engine, has barely grown since 2019.
Now, hard right parties do tend to moderate their most extreme positions as they get closer to actual power.
True. Like largely abandoning talk of exiting the euro or the EU.
But their fundamental resistance to change makes them growth smotherers.
That's the key phrase. Italy's Giorgia Meloni, for example, has notably avoided implementing growth-boosting structural reforms. Populism in this context often preserves an imaginary past, locking in the least productive features of an economy.
Transfers to favored groups, protectionism, hostility to competition.
Yep. And important recommendations for boosting Europe's economy, like those from Mario Draghi, for deeper financial market integration, cutting red tape,
have, as the article states, gone precisely nowhere.
largely attributed to mainstream politicians' fear of providing ammunition to their hard-right rivals by pushing through unpopular but necessary reforms.
And the immediate financial fragility is acutely evident in France.
Very much so. Prime Minister François Bayrou called a confidence vote after opposition parties threatened to reject 44 billion euros in budget savings for 2026.
France's public debt is at 114% of GDP, deficit 5.4%.
Staggering numbers. Investors are, understandably, fretting. France's borrowing costs are now on par with Italy's. The prospect of an RN-led government, that's the Rassemblement National, the hard-right party,
would likely mean little to no cuts to the deficit, exacerbating these concerns.
Absolutely. This compels us to ask, can Europe truly afford the significant shift to the hard-right? The economic costs of protectionism and a fundamental resistance to structural reform are already becoming painfully evident.
The situation in France, with bond vigilantes effectively taking aim, highlights the immediate financial fragility driven by this pervasive political uncertainty.
It's a stark warning for the continent's economic future.
Okay. And as we contemplate Europe's economic shifts, let's zoom in on a stark technological challenge. Robotaxis will be the Sputnik moment for a declining Europe.
Yeah, this one really lays out the problem. It highlights Europe's alarming lag in critical technological sectors.
iPhones, TikTok, semiconductors, AI, primarily developed in China or America.
Right. And robotaxis, the article argues, represent a new frontier where Europe is not only failing to develop the core technology, but may not even gain access to it, becoming entirely reliant on foreign solutions.
Yeah, what are the challenges?
They're multifaceted. Development costs for true robotaxi tech are immense, maybe $100 billion. Europe largely lacks that compared to U.S. tech giants or Chinese state-backed ventures.
And European car makers are focusing elsewhere.
They are. Driver assistance systems, EVs, largely out of a fear that full driverless tech would cannibalize their existing sales and investments.
And beyond economics.
A mood of technological nativism has enveloped the continent. The EU even has a vice president specifically for technological sovereignty.
Driven by deep-seated fears of becoming hooked on yet more foreign tech and concerns about giant snooping machines from China.
Exactly. The profound implication here is that this isn't just about cool new cars. It's a Sputnik moment for Europe.
Highlighting the continent's broader struggle for technological sovereignty and its inability to compete effectively with U.S. and Chinese tech giants in foundational new industries.
Yeah. This reflects much deeper economic and regulatory issues that risk further marginalizing Europe in the global tech race, potentially leaving its citizens reliant on foreign developed and controlled technologies for critical future services and infrastructure.
It's a stark warning about being left behind. Okay, next, let's turn our attention to Britain, starting with the Farage Power Project.
Right. Reform UK, led by Nigel Farage.
Now, alarmingly, on track for government, 31% in national polls, giving it an almost 1 in 2 chance of securing a majority.
It's quite something. The party's ambitious vision is described as a blitzkrieg on the institutions of Donald Trump, aiming to leverage Britain's relatively weak constitutional checks and balances.
To grant a prime minister far greater control over domestic policy.
Exactly. The foundation of Reform UK's surging support is rooted in deep public discontent over immigration and perceived skewed policing. The party plans to explicitly use parliamentary sovereignty as a hatchet against perceived constraints.
Arguing that the direct will of the people, expressed through parliament, must be obeyed without traditional legal or institutional impediments.
Right. A Farage premiership, the article predicts, would have a distinct presidential streak, appointing business leaders directly to cabinet positions rather than relying solely on elected MPs.
And its stated goals are framed with Trumpian hyperbole, even more transformative than Thatcher.
Yeah, strong words. A key and highly controversial initiative would be Operation Restoring Justice.
The plan to deport 600,000 illegal migrants in 5 years.
An astounding number, achieved by unilaterally denouncing international treaties like the Refugee Convention and the European Convention on Human Rights.
They also aim to explicitly draft deportation law to preclude judicial review.
And to systematically clear out what they view as a captured senior civil service. The article anticipates a titanic clash with the House of Lords over these radical reforms.
What are the critiques of this project?
They point to its considerable oversimplification of constitutional history, Farage's well-documented record of public feuds, and a slate of largely vague, poorly costed policies.
Yet, perhaps tellingly, the party actively trumpets its lack of traditional governing experience as an asset.
Right, arguing that if professionals have been in charge for the last 20 years, their disruptive approach couldn't possibly be worse.
This article outlines a genuinely radical shift in British governance, explicitly echoing Trumpian tactics of asserting executive power.
It raises fundamental questions about constitutional checks and balances and the very future of Britain's international commitments and public institutions. Suggests a potentially turbulent era ahead.
Okay, from internal politics to international trade and defense, will British shipbuilders rule the waves again? Delivers some surprisingly positive news amid the turbulence.
Yeah, a bit of good news. Norway has placed a significant £10 billion contract for 5 Type 26 submarine hunting frigates with BAE systems in Glasgow.
Britain's highest value warship export deal ever.
Ever. Historically, Britain's once dominant shipbuilding industry suffered a dramatic decline, plummeting from 60% global share in 1900 to less than 1% today.
Only two major warship firms remaining.
Right. But the tide appears to be turning. The previous government's 2022 shipbuilding strategy outlined an ambitious pipeline of 150 naval and civilian ships over 30 years.
And BAE Systems is actively investing.
£300 million in its Govan shipyard opened its largest shipbuilding hall, aiming to cut construction time by a third and rapidly expanding its workforce. Welders Academy, 200 apprentices per year.
This revival in naval construction also significantly bolsters Britain's geopolitical clout.
Definitely. It explicitly strengthens the AUKUS pact for jointly designing and building advanced nuclear submarines with Australia and America.
And the Type 26 deal with Norway allows for interchangeable use of British and Norwegian sailors for joint patrols in the North Atlantic.
Specifically to hunt Russian submarines. This is not just an economic deal, it's a strategic alliance.
Now, challenges certainly remain. Funding shortfalls, NATO spending targets.
True. But what's fascinating here is that this reflects a broader rearming of Europe and a strategic repositioning for Britain on the global stage.
Leveraging defense exports to bolster both its economy and its geopolitical influence.
Showcasing a genuine resurgence in a historically vital industrial sector. It's a compelling example of defense policy driving economic revival.
Okay, next. How can a middle power compete in artificial intelligence? Delves into Britain's ambitious yet challenging strategy in the global AI race.
Right. Britain made what the article calls a panic buy of Isambard AI, its newest and biggest supercomputer, for £250 million.
Built it in just 10 months, making it the world's 11th fastest.
However, the article critically notes this is far from enough to turn Britain into a computing colossus. Countries like Finland, Germany, Japan already possess more powerful resources.
Britain faces inherent challenges. Expensive electricity, less land oil wealth for data centers compared to the UAE or Canada.
Right. And Labour's pledge of £2 billion for AI investment, while substantial for Britain, is quite small compared to the $320 billion U.S. tech firms will spend this year alone.
So despite these resource limitations, what's Britain's strategy?
Intelligently focusing on nurturing its world-leading AI talent, particularly in machine learning research. Major players like DeepMind and Wave are headquartered in London.
And Isambard AI aims to be a crucial hub for frontier AI model training.
Exactly. Specifically attracting top researchers from America, Switzerland, and the EU. While it isn't large enough to train the absolute biggest language models, it will undoubtedly enable breakthroughs in specialized areas.
Examples like dementia prompts, home robots, life sciences, health.
Yeah, skin cancer detection, drug design, even monitoring cow behavior and moth wings. It's named after Victorian engineer Isambard Kingdom Brunel, symbolizing Britain's hope for a significant stake in the next industrial revolution.
The larger question we're left with is, can a middle power like Britain effectively carve out a competitive niche in the global AI race? Or is the AI competition ultimately a winner-takes-all scenario?
It's a test of smart strategy over brute force, really.
Okay, and now for a compelling story of corporate resilience and strategic reinvention. A cyber attack isn't enough to halt Marks and Spencer's turnaround, alongside how the M&S strawberries and cream sandwich went viral.
Ah, M&S, yeah. A British institution.
Marks and Spencer experienced a significant cyber attack on April 18th, but remarkably continued its impressive transformation from a somewhat tired British institution to a genuinely growing and profitable business under CEO Stuart Machin.
Yeah, just a few years ago, M&S was colloquially described as the flip phones of retail. Drab stores, pricey food, unfashionable clothes, £200 million in pre-tax losses in 2021.
But under Medchen, sales are up over 6%, profits up 22%, stock rallied to its highest level since Brexit.
Quite the turnaround. Their core strategies include offering quality value in food through lower prices, aggressive price matching,
injecting newness into fashion, leading to much higher full price sales,
and investing heavily in store refurbishments and a massive £340 million automated food distribution center.
Despite facing external challenges like high inflation and rising UK business costs,
they've achieved a significant turnaround, and their marketing prowess was clearly on display with the viral success of their strawberries and cream sandwich.
Launched strategically around Wimbledon this summer, became a genuine social media phenomenon,
sparking widespread debate, even among economists, about whether it should be charged 20% VAT, like confectionery, or exempt, like cold sandwiches.
Drawing parallels to the famous Jaffa Cakes legal battle.
Exactly. This is a truly compelling story of corporate resilience and strategic reinvention. It powerfully demonstrates how a legacy brand like M&S successfully navigated significant external shocks and deep-seated internal challenges to achieve a remarkable turnaround.
By leveraging both fundamental business changes and savvy marketing tactics to reconnect with consumers,
it showcases the fine, often cultural line between business strategy and consumer sentiment. It's a great example of adaptation in action.
Okay, finally for Britain, Bash Hot. How to Take Over a Government via PDS reveals the profound and often unseen influence of think tanks.
Ah, the Resolution Foundation.
A center-left think tank has quietly become arguably Britain's most influential economic institution, with many of its alumni now holding key positions within the new Labour government.
Right. Veterans like Thorsten Bell on pensions, Manoush Shafiq as a top economic advisor, they're now actively shaping Labour's spending plans and its crucial supply-side agenda.
The party has even adopted several RF-approved schemes, like levying inheritance tax on pension pots.
And the foundation itself was established in 2005 by Sir Clive Cowdery, who made his fortune in insurance with the explicit mission to help the poor and address income inequality.
What really makes this fascinating is how it reveals the profound influence of think tanks on policymaking, almost like a shadow government emerging from academia and policy research.
It does, and it compels us to ask, can a group fundamentally dedicated to helping the poor maintain its core principles when faced with the harsh fiscal realities of governing a high-rate, high-debt economy?
They may well find themselves having to implement austerity measures that could inadvertently hurt the very people they initially set out to protect.
It's a real-world test of principles versus pragmatism, a tough spot to be in.
Okay, now let's explore some regional developments outside the major European powers. Starting with fires, earthquakes, and inflation are putting tourists off Turkey.
Yeah, Turkey's vital tourism industry is genuinely struggling, facing its fifth consecutive year of massive forest fires along its Mediterranean and Aegean coasts.
It's absolute tourism heartlands.
Exactly. On top of that, hundreds of earthquakes in the Aegean are sparking widespread fears of a truly devastating seismic event.
And persistent high inflation, 33.5% in July, is rapidly eroding its long-held reputation as a budget-friendly getaway.
Mm-hmm. The industry is also witnessing a significant shift in tourist behavior. Visitors are increasingly opting for large, all-inclusive resorts,
which set prices months in advance, benefit from economies of scale.
Right. But this trend severely squeezes smaller independent hotels and self-catering accommodations. Antalya, Turkey's largest hub for all-inclusives, saw a concerning 30% drop in foreign arrivals in Q1 2025.
Interestingly, Turks themselves are increasingly choosing Greece's nearby Aegean islands.
Yeah, where visa on arrival programs and often cheaper Eurozone prices are proving more attractive.
Local initiatives, like in Marmaris, are trying to adapt by focusing on out-of-season events.
Regattas, seafood festival, trying to bring in year-round tourism. However, coastal regions, often controlled by the opposition, claim they receive insufficient promotional and financial support from the central government.
And President Erdogan's rather casual response to devastating 2021 fires, tossing tea packets to locals,
provoked widespread fury. This article vividly illustrates the multifaceted challenges faced by a major tourism economy, from climate change and natural disasters to macroeconomic instability and deep-seated political tensions.
It highlights how external factors and government policies can dramatically reshape an entire vital industry.
Definitely.
Okay, moving to a much more positive economic narrative, Morocco is now a trade and manufacturing powerhouse.
A very different story here. This article describes Morocco's rapid ascent as a global manufacturing and trade hub. Tanger Medport expanding significantly, $40 billion in greenfield manufacturing investment since 2020.
Export surged by two-thirds in just 5 years. Remarkable.
It is. This success is attributed to several key factors. King Mohammed VI's consistent investor-friendly policies, massive infrastructure spending 25-38% of GDP annually from 2001 to 2017.
Transforming the country. High-speed rail, vast wind and solar farms, dynamic special economic zones.
Right. Free trade agreements with the EU since 2000, preferential deals with 60 other countries, attracted major international car makers like Renault, Stellantis, along with their extensive network of suppliers.
Morocco is now the biggest exporter of cars and parts to Europe, surpassing China and Japan.
Remarkably, yes. And Morocco is also skillfully moving up the value chain, demonstrating success in advanced sectors like aerospace, pharmaceuticals, railway equipment.
Notably, Chinese investment is pouring in.
Over $10 billion specifically targeted at EVs and batteries. Chinese investors are described as often showing up unannounced, speak Arabic, and do business fast. A different, more agile approach.
What's truly fascinating here is that while this is undeniably a genuine economic success story,
it also highlights the inherent complexities of global supply chains and geopolitical trade wars. This entanglement with China, for example, could potentially draw Morocco into future Trump-era trade wars.
And concerns within Morocco about neglecting homegrown enterprise.
Yeah, and fiercer competition with Europe is also emerging, leading Morocco to intelligently hedge its bets by increasingly turning to Africa-Nigeria gas pipeline, investment in Casablanca Finance City.
So Morocco's strategic positioning and aggressive investment have created a genuine economic powerhouse.
Absolutely. However, it also illustrates the delicate balancing act required in global trade, forcing even booming economies to constantly diversify to maintain their competitive edge and avoid becoming over-reliant on any single partner.
Okay, now let's turn our attention to Asia, starting with a crucial test for democracy in protests test Indonesia's democracy.
Right. The article details nationwide riots sparked by the tragic death of a motorbike delivery driver crushed by a police vehicle during a protest outside parliament.
And the original protest was over lavish housing allowances for lawmakers, nearly 10 times Jakarta's minimum wage.
Exactly. This incident has ignited widespread anger over what the article calls President Prabowo Subianto's grubby misrule and increasingly heavy-handed policing.
Prabowo, a former general, dislikes opposition, co-opting parties into a ridiculously broad coalition.
Yes, 7 of 8 parties in the lower house, bloated cabinet, over 100 members. He's even openly talked about making this political arrangement permanent, harking back to Indonesia's authoritarian traditions.
And beneath the surface of a seemingly tolerable 5.1% annual growth,
Indonesia faces significant economic mismanagement, premature deindustrialization, manufacturing share of GDP halved in 2 decades. Failure to utilize vast natural resources, effectively still a net oil importer despite reserves, largely neglected solar and wind potential.
Life is demonstrably harder for many ordinary citizens.
Cost of staples like rice jumped 34% in 3 years. Layoffs, rising unemployment for university graduates, surging non-performing household bank loans.
And Prabowo's policy missteps. Budget cuts for school lunches. A new sovereign wealth fund under his control.
Promoting cronyism, reducing government revenues, forcing local tax increases. It's a mess.
How did he respond to the protests?
Initially agreed to cancel the housing allowances, but simultaneously ordered strongest possible lawful actions against rioters, leading to the arrest of a prominent rights advocacy leader.
He is overtly described as nostalgic for the old authoritarian habits of his father-in-law, Suharto.
Yeah. This article outlines a critical test for Indonesia's young democracy. Facing economic grievances and a president with clear authoritarian tendencies. Will protests lead to genuine reforms, or will he push the country towards deeper unrest and democratic erosion?
A crucial moment for them.
Okay,
moving to India, we delve into India is retiring its most celebrated warplane.
The MiG-21, after 62 years of service.
Astonishing. It acquired iconic status, but also, grimly, earned the moniker Flying Coffin due to its dangerous reputation.
Acquired in 1963 after the China War, propelled India into the supersonic age, cemented reliance on Soviet hardware. Around 900 aircraft, most made in India, celebrated for shooting down Pakistani planes in 71.
Even used controversially in the 2019 airstrikes where the pilot became a cult hero.
Right, Abhinandan Vardhman. But the dangers were undeniable. Over 400 Indian MiG-21s crashed over 60 years, killing 200 pilots, 60 civilians.
Due to challenging wing design, narrow tires, engine needing high airspeeds.
making landings perilous. The article makes it clear its long service wasn't legend, but lack of alternatives. The Indian-designed Tejas jet was slow to arrive, initially disliked.
So India upgraded other jets, bought Rafales, but never managed to wholesale replace the huge MiG-21 fleet.
Correct. This creates a significant strategic gap for India. Modern jets are more capable, but quantity still matters. India lost 5 jets to Pakistani missiles in the May conflict.
Worryingly, China now fields approximately 3 combat aircraft for every Indian one.
And this disparity could grow significantly as MiG-21s retire, leaving India with a numerical and potentially technological disadvantage.
This is a fascinating look at the challenges of defense modernization for a major power.
Highlights India's reliance on older technology, difficulty developing domestic alternatives, and the growing strategic imbalance with China.
Okay, from a retiring warplane to a booming city, a genuinely surprising story. Baghdad, the world's surprise boomtown.
It really is surprising. The article describes Baghdad experiencing a significant construction boom, visibly drawing foreign investors, reshaping the capital. Cranes, new pavements, chic new establishments.
What's driving this?
Several key factors. Crucially, vastly improved security, the calmest Iraq has been since 2003. Banking sector reforms making credit more accessible. Oil and construction revenues increasingly spent within Iraq.
And Prime Minister Mohammed al-Sudani is pushing projects through.
Acting like a foreman, aggressively pushing through bureaucracy since taking office in October 2022, built 20 new bridge overpasses in Baghdad 1 in just 80 days. 4 new hospitals, Iraq's first cancer center, 1,700 schools built, rebuilt, half a dozen posh hotels opening.
Major oil companies like BP resuming operations.
Talks with ExxonMobil, Chevron. Modernization efforts are also transforming daily life. Many government services digitized 45-minute passports, bank card payments, once rare, now essential.
And customs income surged dramatically,
right,
ending iPhone as banana smuggling.
Exactly. From 900 billion dinars to over 3 trillion this year. What truly makes this fascinating is it's a compelling story of resurgence from protracted conflict, demonstrating how stability, strong leadership, modernization can drive rapid economic growth.
But Iraq's population is also growing fast, nearly 1 million annually.
Yeah.
And political fragility remains.
Yes. Iran-backed factions within the Shia coordination framework see Sudani as a potential threat. It poses a persistent risk to this newfound prosperity. A delicate balance.
Okay, next. Sri Lanka is still reeling from its economic collapse, despite some initial signs of recovery.
Sri Lanka continues to face widespread and persistent poverty, 24.5% living on $3.65 a day, nearly double 2019 levels.
Malnutrition among children also tragically increased, from 12.2% in 2021 to 17% in 2024. Household income still below pre-crisis levels.
Hopes for a more robust recovery are largely pinned on 2 key sectors. Tourism aiming for 3 million arrivals in 2025, and remittances from overseas workers, $700 million in July.
But the composition of these workers is changing. More higher-paid professionals leaving for good.
Exactly, which implies a significant brain drain, taking expertise with them. This highlights the long, painful tale of economic crises. Even after initial stabilization, the human cost, poverty, malnutrition can persist for years.
It raises crucial questions about sustainable recovery and the long-term impact of brain drain on future development.
Definitely.
Okay, now let's delve into China's internal and external strategy, beginning with China's urban planners could determine the future of city life.
Right. The Communist Party published an incredibly ambitious plan for livable, beautiful, resilient, civilized, and smart cities by 2035.
Aiming to foster innovation, high-tech firms, consumer spending. Significant given 2/3 of China's population is now urban, up 220 million since 2012.
City clusters are central to this grand plan, linking hub cities with smaller neighbors via high-speed rail. The Pearl River Delta Greater Bay Area already houses 86 million people. Shenzhen's underground tracks alone stretch 600 kilometers.
But there are significant inherent challenges. Smart cities inevitably mean real-time surveillance for police.
Coupled with ubiquitous civilian volunteers, clearly indicating tight state control.
The plan also emphasizes upgrading existing housing over large-scale expansion due to the property market slump, and urban development proceeds with minimal citizen consultation.
Funding is another formidable hurdle. No comprehensive cost forecasts. Attaching basic infrastructure could cost 4 trillion yuan, over $500 billion over 5 years. Xi Jinping's City of the Future test case, Xiangyan,
has already seen 835 billion yuan spent, but as the article notes, yet to become a hub of innovation.
What's truly fascinating here is how it reveals China's archetypal top-down approach to urban development, balancing ambitious modernization with strict state control and surveillance.
It compels us to ask, can a smart city truly be livable and civilized if citizens have minimal say and are under constant observation?
Highlights the inherent trade-offs in such a highly centralized model.
Okay, our next article offers a truly fascinating and somewhat quirky glimpse into the anxieties and coping mechanisms of China's youth. The weird and wacky life hacks of China's youth, Shigu.
Shifsu, meaning heretical way, from martial arts novels, now signifies a creative, unconventional, efficient departure from the proper way among young Chinese. Videos tagged with it have billions of views.
Examples range from rendering lard in a microwave to learning English via fanfiction.
Using advanced math for insomnia, nude dining for weight loss, melting ice cream for carbonara sauce, it's quite something.
This burgeoning trend is widely seen as a subtle form of resistance, a middle path between extreme work culture and lying flat.
Exactly. Reflects deep-seated disillusionment with a wobbly economy, high housing costs, shaky job prospects, youth unemployment in cities 17.8% in July.
Well, state media typically frames Yixiu as a cheerful way to seek improvement, avoiding connotations of rebellion.
The underlying sentiment of discontent and creative coping is palpable. This is where it gets genuinely interesting. Yixiu is a significant cultural phenomenon offering a unique window into the anxieties, frustrations, and creative coping mechanisms of China's youth.
A subtle form of resistance or disillusionment channeled into quirky hacks.
Raising profound questions about social mobility, individual expression, and psychological well-being in a highly regulated society shows people always find unique ways to express feelings about their circumstances.
Okay, continuing with China's global interactions, Chinese migrants risked their lives to reach America. For what? Tells a deeply human and often tragic story.
Yeah, the flow of Chinese migrants across the U.S.-Mexico border has now slowed to a mere trickle after more than 67,000 sought freedom and opportunity between 2022-2024.
The story of Agian, a partially blind Chinese man who crossed in 2024.
It's poignant. He now lives in fear of IC, worries about committing speech crime in America, finds it tragic.
What caused the slowdown?
Largely Ecuador's suspension of visa-free entry for Chinese nationals in July 2024, blocking a main transit route. Combined with Trump's intensified border crackdown?
Asylum acceptance rates plummeted from 50% to 20%.
Right. Trump also made unsubstantiated claims they were building an army. Deportations remain rare due to low U.S.-China diplomatic relations. China only resumed accepting removal flights in June 2024 after stopping in 2018. Trump's admin has only managed one large removal flight.
And the risks of returning to China are severe.
Detention, interrogation, fines, passport confiscation, up to 3 years imprisonment for illegal border crossing. Genuine asylum seekers face harsher punishment.
This deeply human story highlights the grim reality faced by migrants seeking a better life.
Caught between political crackdowns in both home and destination countries, also reveals the diplomatic complexities and geopolitical tensions impacting individual lives, turning personal aspirations into global political pawns. A sobering reminder.
On the economic front, China Turns Crypto Curious reveals China's complex and evolving relationship with cryptocurrency.
Largely driven by its deep wariness of the U.S. dollar's global dominance, amplified after the U.S. Genius Act paved the way for regulated dollar stablecoins aiming to entrench dollar dominance.
How is China responding?
Strategically. Shanghai Cooperation Organization members, China, India, Russia, promised to settle more transactions in local currencies. China's yuan-settled current account transactions rose from 15% in 2019 to 30% in H1 2025. China's cabinet is reportedly considering a roadmap for yuan-backed stablecoins.
But this presents a dilemma for Beijing.
Yeah.
Given the crypto ban and capital controls.
Exactly. Stablecoins might inherently weaken those controls. Hong Kong is playing a crucial role here, with new stablecoin legislation effective August 1st.
Mandating capital requirements, backing by safe assets, KYC, anti-money laundering, first licenses likely for HKD-pegged stablecoins.
Yes, and what's ironic here is the Hong Kong dollar itself is tied to the U.S. dollar, backed by vast USD assets held by the HKMA.
Creating a fascinating geopolitical irony.
Right. Successful Hong Kong stablecoins could actually increase demand for the underlying dollar assets, obliging the HKMA to buy even more U.S. dollars and potentially more U.S. government debt.
This reveals China's profoundly complex relationship with crypto, driven by strategic desire to reduce dollar dependence or constrained by domestic controls.
And that geopolitical irony is a fascinating twist, underscoring the deep, often unexpected interconnectedness of global finance and geopolitics.
Another significant economic dynamic emerging in Asia is explored in The Threat of Deflation Stalks Asia's Economies.
Yeah, much of Asia now experiencing disinflation or even outright deflation. Consumer prices actively falling in China, Thailand, near deflation in the Philippines. Average inflation across the continent's 10 biggest economies, excluding Japan, Bangladesh, is a tame 1.3%.
And this isn't just Trump's tariffs yet.
No, the article clarifies this trend predates his re-election. The primary culprits are, firstly, pervasive Chinese overcapacity. It's entrenched domestic deflation in China and pushed down prices globally.
China's export price index fell 15% since 2022. Goods trade surplus with developing Asia almost doubled.
Driving down prices of cars in Thailand, cheap Chinese models, smartphones in Vietnam, Singapore. Secondly, quiescent commodity markets have had a cooling effect.
OPEC plus increased drilling, keeping oil prices stable. Food inflation subsided from 5% to 1% across Asia.
Partly due to pork price deflation in China, where officials even pledged to combat this by shrinking herds.
The impact here is significant. A major economic divergence. Asia facing deflation while the U.S. battles inflation.
It's presented as a symptom of faltering economic health in Asia, driven by China's overcapacity and global commodity dynamics, forcing countries across the region to intensify their search for new markets, potentially cut prices further.
Which could lead to a global race to the bottom in pricing. Unpredictable consequences.
Could be.
Okay, finally for this section, a new theory of China's rise, rule by engineers, offers a provocative new framework for understanding China's rapid development.
Dan Wang's book, Breakneck, argues China is fundamentally an engineering state. Rapidly building colossal infrastructure motorways, high-speed rail, solar wind, producing 13 global manufactured goods.
Contrasted sharply with America, which he argues is ruled by lawyers perpetually debating rather than building.
Wang emphasizes China's remarkable engineering prowess, attributed to an intuition gained over decades by millions of factory workers and managers, transforming China into a tech powerhouse for smartphones, drones. Xi Jinping prioritizes the real economy. China leads in clean tech, ultra-high voltage, 5G.
However, the article offers a critical perspective on the excesses of this engineering state.
Right. While Wang attributes failures, overcapacity, debt, environmental destruction, human cost to these excesses, the article argues they actually stem from political incentives in China's rigid, top-down authoritarian system, rather than engineering principles.
The one-child policy is cited as a powerful example.
Yes. While a missile scientist formulated it, the Communist Party's acceptance and brutal implementation were crucial, leading to 321 million abortions, 108 million sterilizations.
Starkly lacking the ethical cost-benefit analysis and iterative adaptation of a proper engineering-based approach.
Exactly. This offers a provocative framework for understanding China's rapid development, emphasizing technical expertise and execution. However, it also critically points out that political authoritarianism, not engineering principles, drives many major policy flaws and human costs, reveals the dark side of unchecked centralized power.
Okay, let's transition now to some of the most exciting and critical developments in science, innovation, and future trends.
Right, looking forward.
We'll start with what appears to be a genuine paradigm shift in cancer research. Scientists are discovering a powerful new way to prevent cancer.
This was really fascinating. It highlights a revolutionary new approach focused on actively encouraging healthy cells rather than solely eliminating unhealthy ones.
Traditionally, cancer was understood as starting with DNA mutations leading to uncontrolled cell multiplication, tumor formation.
Right. But recent groundbreaking discoveries are fundamentally challenging this. Phil Jones's research at Wellcome Sanger Institute found cancer-driving mutations in the PIK3CA gene cause specific metabolic changes. These changes help mutated cells aggressively outcompete healthy ones,
giving them an advantage.
Exactly. And here's where it gets truly exciting. In recent mouse trials, metformin, a common diabetes drug, was found to introduce the exact same metabolic change in non-mutated esophageal cells. This intervention effectively halted the growth of PIK3CA mutations by, as the article puts it, leveling the arms race between healthy and mutated cells.
Wow. And conversely, high-fat diets boosted troublesome cells, strengthening the obesity cancer link.
Mm-hmm. Furthermore, Alan Balmain's study at UC yielded a surprising finding. Only 3 out of 20 known carcinogens actually induced mutations in mice. The vast majority promoted tumor growth by instead affecting the immune system.
Suggesting 80 to 90% of carcinogens might be non-mutagenic.
That's the implication. These non-mutagenic carcinogens, the research posits, cause chronic inflammation, creating wounds that never heal, environments that actively encourage cancer driver cells to form tumors.
And Charles Swanson's study linked urban air pollution to lung cancers in non-smokers via inflammation, specifically the interleukin-1's protein.
Yes. And crucially, drugs that block this interleukin-1's protein suppress tumors in mice. This opens up a completely new preventative approach, strategically targeting the immune system and its inflammatory responses instead of solely focusing on mutations.
Identifying these key inflammatory molecules is paramount. New drugs could help the body limit harm from its own immune system.
Exactly. The potential beneficiaries are immense. High-risk individuals, BRCA genes, former smokers, previous cancer patients, those with precancerous tissues, polyps, lesions.
The profound impact is this represents a genuine paradigm shift, moving beyond just gene mutations to understanding the crucial role of the cellular environment and the immune system.
This could be game-changing for cancer prevention, offering new hope as lifespans increase and cancer incidence rises, potentially revolutionizing how we think about and combat this disease.
Okay, from health to energy, burying nuclear reactors might make them cleaner and cheaper, introduces a truly innovative concept.
Almost counterintuitive, yeah. Deep Fission, an aspiring nuclear firm, proposes building small modular reactors a mile deep in Earth's crust, filled with water.
Aiming to minimize leaks, permanently dispose of waste, and significantly cut costs, all in one elegant solution.
It's incredibly elegant. The pressure at 1.6 kilometers deep precisely matches the optimal operating pressure for conventional PWRs. This eliminates the need for expensive pressurizers, strong pressure vessels, massive containment vessels.
The surrounding earth and rock act as the ultimate containment.
Exactly. The idea originated from Elizabeth Muller, Deep Fission's CEO, who previously worked on deep isolation, burying reactor waste in deep shafts.
Is it feasible?
Actively being established. Engineers are reportedly close to a preliminary core design for a relatively narrow core. Drilling wide, deep shafts is considered entirely feasible, drawing on experience from underground nuclear warhead testing. Encouragingly, the U.S. Energy Department selected Deep Fission for its nuclear reactor pilot program to accelerate testing.
And the economics look compelling.
They do. Each unit, $30 million, projected to produce 15 milliW at 5.27 cents kilowatt. Competitive. Immediate market for power-hungry data centers deal with Endeavor already. Grid-scale facilities would be even cheaper than current surface PWRs.
The profound impact. This innovative concept addresses several major, long-standing challenges of nuclear power safety, waste, cost, in one elegant stroke.
It could genuinely revolutionize the industry, especially for decentralized power needs like data centers. Represents a significant step towards making nuclear energy far more viable and scalable.
Okay. Building on that, why nuclear is now a booming industry discusses a significant resurgence for nuclear energy after two decades of struggle.
Unexpected for some, maybe. This revival is driven by three key factors: Western governments' renewed desire for secure, independent electricity, big tech's thirst for reliable power and concern for emissions, and novel operational and financial models improving nuclear's economics.
In the U.S., there's significant political momentum. Rick Perry's Make America Nuclear Again. Trump's target of quadrupling capacity to 400 GW by 2050.
Ambitious targets. The One Big Beautiful Bill Act provides crucial tax credits. Republican and even some blue states are actively welcoming new plant developments. Fermi America building an 11 GW complex in Texas with Westinghouse AP1000 reactors.
Efficiency and investment are also rising.
Definitely. Companies like Constellation investing heavily in existing plants, expecting 710 GW from incremental improvements alone. Big tech support could add another 30 GW. Nuclear developers raising hundreds of millions. Listed nuclear company shares have skyrocketed since Trump's executive orders signaled government backing.
And economic improvements are being observed.
Clearly. China and South Korea demonstrated large reactors can be built efficiently in around 5 years, on budget through standardized designs, multiple reactors per site, keeping supply chains active.
While significant challenges remain, economics, regulation, supply chains, skilled labor, fickle investment.
True. Hurdles remain. But there is undeniable optimism. X Energy Building, SMRs, Amazon invested. The profound impact. The confluence of geopolitical shifts, climate goals, big tech's energy demands. is fueling a genuine nuclear renaissance,
highlighting the potential for nuclear to play a much larger, essential role in future energy mixes.
Those significant hurdles still need to be overcome.
Now, let's turn to a critical debate reshaping our understanding of artificial intelligence. What if artificial intelligence is just a normal technology?
Right. This discusses a provocative paper by Princeton computer scientists arguing AI should fundamentally be treated as normal technology, like past revolutions.
Challenging the utopian-dystopian views, seeing AI as unprecedented intelligence.
Their argument leads to fundamentally different conclusions on adoption, jobs, risks, policy. They contend constraints on AI innovation, extensive real-world testing, slow, costly integration into regulated fields mean economic impacts are likely to be gradual.
Jobs will increasingly involve AI control, configuring, monitoring, intervening, rather than wholesale displacement. Because AI is too error-prone to make business sense without human oversight.
That's their argument. They also critique the intense emphasis on alignment, ensuring outputs match human goals. Arguing harm depends on context a model lacks. The same text could be marketing copy or a phishing email.
Instead, they suggest strengthening existing measures like cybersecurity, biosafety as more effective defenses against misuse, which also builds resilience to non-AI threats.
Exactly. While the paper received critiques maybe too blasé about labor disruption, it provides a crucial counter-narrative to the prevailing hype and fear.
Grounding AI firmly in historical and practical realities.
Its profound impact is challenging us to think far more pragmatically about AI's integration and risk management, rather than solely focusing on its extraordinary potential or apocalyptic dangers. A call for grounded realism.
Okay. Building on that, who is winning in AI, China or America, explores the major prize of global AI governance, and suggests a surprising shift.
Yeah, while few would have initially bet on China, a distinct Beijing effect is emerging, contrasting with the California effect in tech and Brussels effect in regulation.
China's approach, historically restrictive, is evolving. The DeepSeek moment showed advanced LLMs could be produced with fewer resources.
Right. China, the article posits, is focusing on a values-free, results-based vision, pouring immense resources into developing cheap, accessible, good enough applications. Contrast with the U.S. viewing AI supremacy like splitting the atom.
And Angela Huyu Zhang's paper argues China's regulation is more pragmatic and industry-friendly than outsiders perceive.
Strict info control coexists with lax enforcement of privacy copyright for development. Officials share government data, judges accelerate AI development.
This is where it gets truly interesting. The global competition for AI leadership isn't just tech breakthroughs, it's differing regulatory philosophies.
China's values-free, results-based approach, leveraging state power and data, poses a significant challenge to Western models focused on privacy, democratic values. The profound impact. This clash of governance models will fundamentally shape AI development, applications, societal integration globally.
It's a contest of systems, not just algorithms.
Exactly.
Okay, let's turn our attention now to how culture, media, and individual legacies are shaping our world. Starting with a rather concerning trend highlighted in is the decline of reading making politics dumber.
Yeah, this article argues forcefully that reading, particularly for pleasure and sustained engagement, is in trouble. Multiple studies show global decline across all age groups, socioeconomic classes.
The evidence is stark. Erica, 2/5 fallen reading for pleasure in 20 years. UK,
yeah.
40% not re-listened to books in 2024. English lit students flummoxed by legal language and baffled by metaphor in classics.
Struggling with basic vocabulary. And it's not just reading less, the texture is changing. Sentences in popular books have contracted by almost a third since the 1930s. John Ruskin's 153-word first sentence versus Mel Robbins' 19 words.
Smartphones often blamed, but the article notes reading has always been a bother, citing ancient Greeks, 4th-century monks. The deeper issue seems a fundamental decline in the sheer desire to read.
Contrast with Victorian zeal for self-advancement. Shepherds saving to buy Thucydides. Despite books being cheaper, more accessible, reading rates fall, perhaps because, as the article concludes, people just cannot be bothered. Professors lament waning attention spans.
The political implications are profound. UK parliamentary speeches shrunk by a third in a decade. US inaugural addresses readability declined to Washington postgraduate level, Trump high schooler level.
This shrinking discourse and loss of nuance means society is losing the ability to develop complex ideas that allow you to see nuance and to hold two contradictory thoughts together. The medium is the message, and that message is currently 280 characters long.
beyond intellectual capacity, reading historically an egalitarian engine of social mobility.
So it compels us to ask, what are the broader societal costs of this decline? Suggests a direct link between decreasing literary political sophistication, dumber politics, less nuanced thinking, potential erosion of social mobility, a real challenge to critical thinking.
Okay, moving to personal stories that ripple through culture. Mother, not always dearest, Arundhati Roy on her parent.
Explores the profound influence of personal relationships on shaping a public intellectual. Roy's first memoir details her complex relationship with her mother, Mary Roy. Dreamer, warrior, teacher, fought for equal inheritance rights, but also had a darkness.
After her Booker Prize win, Roy became a prominent polemicist against nuclear testing, for Kashmiri independence, against U.S. wars, Hindu nationalism.
The article highlights how her mother's fierce independence, their turbulent relationship, 7-year estrangement, profoundly shaped her into the writer and fighter she became. Despite financial stability, Roy felt spiritual discomfort about privilege amidst India's poverty,
leading her to use her platform for causes, even facing contempt of court, anti-terrorism prosecution.
Her memoir employs a touch of lightness to weighty concerns, veering into magical realism, the only kind of realism I knew, she says. This piece explores the profound influence of formative relationships, a powerful narrative about finding freedom, using one's voice, even at great personal cost, to fight for justice.
Highlighting how deep personal struggles can fuel a lifelong commitment to social change. Okay, from literary figures to sports, quarterbacks shoulder an immense burden on the field, by Seth Wickersham.
Examines the immense psychological pressure on NFL quarterbacks, arguably the most demanding position in team sports. Highest paid players, yet most first round picks since 2000 considered failures.
Wickersham profiles legends like Unitas, Elway, but also follows young prospects like Colin Hurley, leading a fiercely limited existence in the hopes of an expansive life. College football, a great winnowing.
As the sport becomes more statistical, tolerance for mistakes shrinks, making the game less real, less instinctive, less open to improvisation. The mental toll is immense. Few who reach the summit appreciate it. Elway felt relief, young deflation.
Retirement often brings struggles with drink, drugs, infidelity. Driven by a deep imperative to dominate and a bottomless hole in their personality once that purpose is gone.
This is a deep dive into the psychological burden of extreme performance. Illustrates how pursuit of glory can come at significant personal cost, revealing the dark side of ambition and the challenge of transitioning out of a singular identity. Really makes you rethink the glamour.
Moving to modern entertainment, Girl Band v. Demons, the secrets of Netflix's most popular film, K-pop Demon Hunters,
reveals why this animated musical unexpectedly became Netflix's most popular film. A potent combination of catchy K-pop songs and strategic appeal to dedicated K-pop fandom.
Features K-pop's hook-heavy style, producers from Blackpink, BTS, songs hit Billboard Hot 100. Fictional group Huntrix had a song covered by actual K-pop group twice.
Its biggest strength is profound engagement with loyal fandom. Plot centers on Hanmoon, a magical barrier powered by fan souls. Fan scenes authentically portray diverse viewers.
This is a fascinating look at the strategic use of pop culture trends and fan engagement to create a massively successful media product.
Demonstrates how understanding and leveraging a dedicated community translates into significant commercial and cultural impact. Highlights the power of targeted content and fan bases.
Similarly, The Paper is less spin-off from than clone of The Office, highlights a broader trend where familiarity trumps originality.
This new comedy from the same producers of American The Office, described as a clone, raising questions about creativity.
However, familiarity sells. The Office itself gained massive streaming popularity since 2021. Viewers crave familiarity in a crowded content landscape.
Highlights a trend where nostalgia often wins. Suggests in an age of content overload, a reliable old ship can be more successful than a brand new one. Raises questions about creative risk-taking in mass media.
Now let's explore some impactful business leaders and legacies. First, an incredibly inspiring obituary. Steve Shirley countered sexism by founding her own company.
Steve Shirley, refugee, entrepreneur, philanthropist, died age 91, founded a software company in 1962 just for women to counter rampant sexism she faced.
Early experiences, pinching, being ignored in meetings, started her company with £6 from her dining table, capitalized on male employers, ignoring married female graduates, hiring the best who needed only a phone.
Her strategies were cunning. Disguised remote workforce with fixed prices, played typing tapes for male clients, signed letters as Steve, not Stephanie, to get meetings, relishing the surprise.
By the 1990s, company employed 8,500, valued at $3 billion by 2000. program Concord's Black Box, became a dame, Companion of Honor.
Her philanthropy, equally impactful, gave most of her stake to staff, 70 millionaires, set up centers for autistic young people after her son Giles's death, advocating for care. Truly inspiring story of overcoming adversity, sexism through ingenuity, resilience, empowering women. Powerful legacy of business success combined with profound social impact.
Okay, from an enduring legacy to a contemporary brand facing challenges, how Lululemon fell out of fashion.
Examines why the athleisure brand, once synonymous with expensive leggings, is falling out of fashion. Sales declining in America, shares down 45% since January.
For over a decade, remarkable success. High margins, high sales per square foot. Third biggest global sportswear company. Now struggling to interest existing customers in latest products, shoes, casual wear.
Lack of marketing buzz, spends 5% revenue versus On's 10%. U.S. shop visits dropped 8%. China sales slowing, consequences, discounting core products, leggings due to 23% inventory jump. Brand, easy to copy, sued Costco.
Illustrates the fickle nature of fashion. Even successful brands can quickly lose edge if they fail to adapt. Highlight constant need for innovation, connection, and retail.
A tough market.
Finally, Google and Apple dodge an antitrust bullet, reveals a dramatic shift in the regulatory landscape for tech giants.
Yeah. A federal judge ruled Google is an illegal monopolist, but rejected the government's demand to break it up, citing generative AI as fundamentally changing the case.
AI, initially an existential threat to Google's search, ironically became its savior by creating a new competitive landscape.
Judge Mehta said DOJ overreached. AI brought big changes to search. Billions invested in generative AI startups, ChatGPT, Claude, Perplexity, used for search-like functions. Google search queries on Safari declined for first time in 22 years.
A major reprieve for Google Apple. Google must share search data, exclusive deals banned, but payments to partners like Apple, tens of billions for default search, allowed to avoid crippling harm.
And Google's EU antitrust fine over ad tech reportedly delayed, linked to US-EU tariff negotiations. The profound impact emergence of generative AI dramatically altered the regulatory landscape, giving tech giants a reprieve from what could have been the biggest antitrust breakup in decades.
Highlights how quickly technological shifts can reshape legal and economic power dynamics, turning a threat into an advantage.
Amazing turn of events.
We've just taken a whirlwind tour through The Economist for the week of September 6th to 12th, 25, covered everything from deep political currents to subtle shifts in daily lives and the future of tech.
Indeed. From complex power plays in the Middle East, strategic lessons from Finland, to the surprising economic resurgence in Baghdad and the quiet revolution in cancer prevention, it's clear the world is in constant dynamic motion, driven by myriad interconnected forces.
We've seen how digital innovations, super apps, stable coins are fundamentally reshaping governance and global finance. We've delved into the profound influence of think tanks, charted shifting fortunes of retail giants, pondered social implications of how we consume information.
And this brings us to a particularly thought-provoking point. The simultaneous decline of deep reading and the rise of creative Dexu life hacks in China, coupled with the worrying weaponization of language in American politics, truly makes you wonder about the future of critical thinking and societal resilience. How will we navigate this changing landscape?
Mm-hmm.
And looking ahead, how will the reevaluation of AI as a normal technology, combined with rapid advancements in cancer prevention and nuclear power, reshape our fundamental understanding of progress and risk in the coming decades? These are the kind of questions that really build on the source material. They'll stay with you long after this deep dive, prompting continued reflection.
Keep exploring, keep questioning, and keep making those crucial connections. Until next time, stay curious.